Folks, today's episode is brought to you by SiriusXM Satellite Radio. You may already know that SiriusXM brings you the deepest variety of commercial-free music for every genre and for every mood. That's where you hear the biggest names in talk, entertainment and comedy, and hundreds of hand-curated music channels designed to fit every mood. It's where you get news from every source. It's where you can listen to the newly launched Fish Radio, woo! In addition to Jam On, the Grateful Dead Radio, Pearl Jam Radio, Tom Petty Radio, and many more. It's where you can listen to top comedy channels such as Kevin Hart's Laugh Out Loud Radio and Netflix Is a Joke Radio, and sports talk radio from Barstool to ESPN and more to keep you up to date on the latest news in the sports world. Most people think you need a car to enjoy SiriusXM, but you don't. Subscribe now and listen outside the car, on your phone, online, and at home. And get your first 3 months for just a dollar. Visit SiriusXM.com/amigos, A-M-I-G-O-S, to see offer details and to subscribe and start listening today. That's SiriusXM, no car required. What's up? This is Mike Fenoya from Amigos, and Amigos Podcast is In the Loop, the legion of Osiris Podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with podcasts and live experiences about artists and topics you love. Check out OsirisPod.com and stay in the loop. All right, welcome back to Amigos. It's Mike. It's your host. It's your friend. Hope you guys are doing great. We have a fun episode today. I've got Ari Shaffir, my friend, stand-up comedian, host of Skeptic Tank Podcast, creator of This Is Not Happening. It's got a Netflix specials. One special is two specials. And then I've got Dr. Will Sue, MD and founder of Kura NYC, where he provides ketamine facilitated psychotherapy and MDMA psychotherapy, and he founded Kura Transpersonal Healing. We talk microdosing, we talk pharmaceuticals, we talk about inspiration and all that other crap. So it's a really fun episode, and I hope you stick around and listen to it. But let's get the business out of the way, guys. Go to iTunes and rate and review and subscribe and tell your friends all about us. And then go to the Amigos Podcast Discussion Group and join and let's talk. And then go to Spotify and follow Mike Fenoya, the artist. That's me. And then keep an eye out for my side project, Still Chasing, that's going to be coming out real soon. It's I did some research over the summer tour, looking back on almost a quarter century of seeing Fish concerts, and I have a lot of fun interviews with a lot of fun people, and that'll be coming out in the early fall, so keep an eye for that. And then go to social media, at M-I-K-E-F-I-N-O-I-A, at A-M-I-G-O-S-P-O-D. And then, guys, Osiris Network, the network I'm on here, the home to some unbelievable podcasts and great people that run it. I mean, the list goes on. I'm not even going to like it. Just go look. There's so many. There's an ass for every seat, and we've got the seats for you guys. That's what I'm going to pitch. That should be our thing. We're the seat for your ass. So head over and listen to all the great podcasts that we have here. And after Dicks, I'm going to be doing a night, Tuesday night, at Comedy Works South. Comedy Works Comedy Club, legendary, amazing, amazing room. Every comic's favorite. Every comic has like a pack of five or six rooms that are on the road. The road is like not New York or LA. That's what comics, if you ever hear comedy people talking about the road, it's not New York or LA. It's everywhere else. And Comedy Works in Denver is always in everyone's list of like the top rooms. Because Wendy, who runs it, is amazing, and the staff is just so damn cool. It's like family. It's fun when you go on the road and you go to a comedy club that you've been at a couple times and the staff is like stoked to see you and you pick up right where you left off. And it's that part of this is, it's like such a warm blanket. And you're just like, these people are actually my friends. They're not just employees at a comedy club that don't look you in the eyes. And those people tend to turn over quick, but the people that are having fun, they're the best. So anyway, I'm going to be out in Colorado for an extra day or two. So if you're staying out there, you go to MikeFinoy.com, figure out all the info for that. I'm bad at plugging things, but obviously if you want to come see me do stand-up after seeing three fish shows, we're probably all going to be in the same mindset. That's going to be my punchline for everything. It's like, oh, you thought it was Bowie, and then it turned out to be Mays. Am I right? You know what I'm talking about, lady. So today, Ari Shaffir and myself and Dr. Will Sue speak about microdosing and about ketamine therapy and about using psychedelics to remain in the present moment and bring consciousness ahead a step. But yeah, it's an interesting conversation. I talk pretty openly about the anxiety and the, you know, panic and the depression and whatever. I think we all deal with it on a little bit of a level, but I think it's important to get it out there and talk about. I think mental health is something that we all need to address and, you know, acknowledge that it's there and take care of each other and be a little bit more empathetic. I mean, look, I'm not saying we don't break balls. This, like, you know, PC police shit is garbage, but I think that it's important to know that, like, if somebody is, you know, hurting or whatever, you can turn to someone else. You don't have to go through it alone. But you have to take care of number one first. And that's what I was interested to speak with Dr. Sue about. And his story is very interesting. He went from very Western medical education to a DMT trip. And now he's partnered with MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. And he works with psychedelics as a way. One thing he said that he kind of just breezes over here in the interview is that with the help of psychedelics, you can get like 20 or 30 years of work done in like 5 to 6 sessions. And that's the thing I think I like the most about this concept of dealing with therapy with the aid of a psychedelic. You know, because you take Molly and you won't shut up and you're telling everybody you love them and you're doing, you know. If you can take it and sit in a room with a therapist and get deep into wherever you got to go, you probably get a lot done fast. Same with ketamine. I've never done ketamine. I've watched people, you know, spill a Bud Light can and a bong full of gross bong water on a dorm floor thanks to a K-hole. But I'm sure they were probably doing either too much or garbage K or whatever. Now it's, you know, regulated by the FDA because it's legal and whatever. So it's definitely changed. But I was interested to chat with him about this because I wanted to bring this information out there to the listeners of Amigos because maybe it's something that can help you. Maybe you're interested in it. So if there's anything else you want to chat me to chat with people about, hit me up. Go into the old DMs or AmigosPod@gmail.com or the Facebook discussion group. And let me know what you think. I know some of you sent me the questions that you had for about microdosing, and I wanted to ask Dr. Sue these questions, but we were kind of at a little bit of a time crunch, and I'm going to have him back for another Q&A episode where we're going to answer all your questions. But I kind of hoped to get a framework, kind of directions on how to microdose properly. And from what it seems like, you take it one day on, you take 3 days off, you take 1 day, 3 days off, and you take about a 0.2 to 0.3 tenths of a gram dose of mushrooms and a tiny 1/100th, I think, or 1/10th of a, I don't know, he talks about it, of a hit of acid. And that's how you do your own microdosing. So I'm not a doctor. I'm not saying that's what you do or you should, but I guess my whole thing is if you're going to do it, do the research, make sure you're doing it right. So enjoy the episode. Thank you for coming back and hanging. I hope you have a great week, and I will be back next week with another fun episode of Amigos Podcast. And until then, take care of yourselves, okay, guys? Love you. Bye.
Hey there, this is Kyle Hollingsworth. You're listening to Amigos with Mike Fenoya on the Osiris Network.
It's Mike Fenoya. We're back with another episode of Amigos. I'm here with my pal, CEO and founder of Shroom Fest and Shafir Fest.
Most CEO.
And executive director, Ari Shafir.
Yeah.
Hi, pal.
Hi. I can verify that everything he said so far is correct.
Yes. It's Shafir
Fest. This is his podcast.
And it's your festivals. And also sitting with us is the founder of Kura.
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 Uh-huh.
NYC,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Will Siu, thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to meet you. And I was very interested in like how there's like a lot of like the LSD, psilocybin, ketamine, DMT
for treatments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm into just dosing.
Right.
That's mostly what I'm into.
Is dosing.
Music.
Yeah.
Just regular.
Well, that's
dosing.
The thing, right? I think that like we all know how to party with it. You know what I mean? You just take a nice big amount and have a great time.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in the fact that you went from the Western of Western medicine, right? I mean, looking at your background in school, UC Irvine, UCLA, Oxford, National Institute of Health, and now you're working in Manhattan doing house calls.
I do a little bit of everything. Yeah, mostly work out of an office in Midtown and see people weekly for psychotherapy. A lot of the people that I see now have found me through psychedelic work. Some people I use ketamine to be a part of their treatment, or for some people it's what we call integration therapy. So they've had an experience at an ayahuasca retreat or with an underground therapist, they'll come see me to talk about it. Or, if they're hell bent on actually going to an ayahuasca retreat, cause I can't legally say I'm recommending it. You know, we do some work around preparing as much as possible for,
So what do? You just tell them like, well, here's what you should expect, but you don't say do it.
No, so I don't really tell them I see why someone's going into it. What are they looking for in it? Because the reality is, I think that really the work that we can do with psychedelics, we can do completely sober, right? My favorite definition of a psychedelic, there's this old kind of grandfather of the psychedelic movement named Stanislav Grof, who was a psychiatrist who worked with Albert Hofmann, who discovered LSD in the Czech Republic. So during his psychiatry residency, he was actually seeing patients legally for LSD psychotherapy. And legally, he's seen over 4,500 sessions of LSD psychotherapy over the course of his career before they made it illegal. And so his definition of a psychedelic is a non-specific amplifier of the unconscious process. And I know that's a long sentence, but it just honors that. You know, it's opening up something within us that we're already fully capable of doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like it gets you back down to like that base level where like you finally get through the mind chatter and you're able to. I think the thing I experience so much with psychedelics that I love so much is how every single moment seems to like feel like a million years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. That part I love because I feel like I'm not experiencing on a day-to-day basis. I'm not experiencing the joy of the moment because of my own bullshit.
What do you mean?
I feel like I'm always wrapped up in anxiety about certain things or fears about certain, how they say worry is about the past, anxiety is about the future.
Yeah.
I'm kind of always in there and I'm missing the moment.
When you're on drugs? No, when I'm not. Normally.
So I'm saying that's the thing I love so much about psychedelics is that it gets you.
Or it can get us there, right? It could also cause a lot of suffering and anxiety as well.
Anxiety.
But I love what you just said because I think of what we're all looking for is the state of being fully present or being fully in flow. And a version of I have of what you just said is that, living in the future is really anxiety because we're just worried, or living in the past is depressions. Like that's what I think of in the general spectrum of psychiatric illness. And what we really want to be is just fully present. And so one of the things as I prepare people or they're considering a psychedelic experience is seeing what are they expecting to get out of it? Because a lot of people at this point are thinking this is a silver bullet. I'm just going to go do ayahuasca in Costa Rica or Peru for a week and I'm going to be good. I'll just be back at it. And everything's going to be perfect in a week, but that's really not the case. You know, I say something like 90% of the long-term benefit of psychedelic use comes in the sober integration work that you do in the weeks and months after. You know, they're not silver bullets. It's how do you come back to just being present and in flow in sober everyday life?
Absolutely. You know? Well,
Can I compare it to something?
Sure.
Like, so like, you know, when like someone you know dies and it kind of brings everybody together,
mm-hmm.
and then you're like, you know what, we gotta just like come together more and like be friends, and like it's the little things that matter, you know. And then like 2 weeks later, you remember thinking that, and you're like, hey, let's get together for lunch.
Yeah,
it's incredible that you said. We actually just this week went through that with a buddy, and I was thinking about that too, about how like I went home and I was like more patient and loving with my wife, and I was more like, you know, compassionate, talk to my family that I haven't talked to in forever.
Mm.
And yeah, I'm like,
6 months from now, how are we going to keep that
exactly
going?
Then like someone's going to call and I'll be like, Jesus, they're calling again, you know what I mean? So it's like, how do you make that last? And I've experienced tons of psychedelic moments, whether it's on, you know, a substance or floating in a tank or meditating or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And they seem to be fleeting, you know, and it's like, I'm going to hold on to this forever. I learned something, and I would, that's kind of my hope, is to like be able to stretch this a little longer, and then when I feel it kind of fading, you know, plug back in and charge up again.
How do you do it? What are your methods?
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know. It's interesting. I've never had a podcast go this way this quickly. I was just having like a very existential kind of conversation with a buddy of mine out in Tompkins Square. But, you know, this thing about having a peak experience essentially is what we're talking about, whether it's with psychedelics or someone dies, as we're saying. I mean, this is at the individual level somewhat. But I also think about what's happening in the world right now, right? In terms of like a crisis, like a, you know, when I think back to high school, like getting, you know, the president, meaning Clinton, getting a blowjob back then was world news. Everyone was paying attention, and look where the world's going. And then there's September 11th, and now there are all these school shootings in the last week. And it's like things are having to get like more and more peak and more violent and more, you know, just big for us to pay any attention. And then within a day or two, we settle back down as a community, mm-hmm. you know? So this is not only happening at the individual level. It's like the collective is experiencing the same thing of how do we get present again as a whole?
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm so passionate about this, is not because I think, I mean, I love my patients. You know, I have gotten a lot of healing out of this at an individual level. But for me, this is the biggest hope for a collective kind of healing of culture, of just how do we just be like fucking normal with each other and just be loving, and everyone's talking around it, but it's we don't know where this is going
to
go.
Yeah. And it seems to me one of the things I think about quite a bit, and I'll be honest and admit it, that like I've been prescribed Wellbutrin, Lexapro, this one, that one, all types of medication for like anxiety and depression and all that. And I don't take them because I hated how mechanical and toxic it made me feel. And I've had such incredible experiences on psychedelics. And I even remember thinking way back, like, I just wish I can figure out how to take like just a little bit and feel the benefits without, you know, and then go on with my day, like get on the subway.
I've been for so long, but it's like mushrooms, the worst thing that's going to happen to you is you're going to barf. And then, like, that's
I know. So but just less. How like a doctor will tell you, take this every morning, take Lexapro every morning, and then you go live your normal work and go to the gym and go on dates, whatever. Psychedelics, it's like almost kind of a little bit scary, where it's like, I don't want to be like on the freeway and then start to, you know, come on.
Yeah.
And then, you know, things get a little bit radical.
Yeah.
Know?
Well, it's the complete opposite of what we're doing, you know. And one of the messages I have is for, you know, the general public to how to use psychedelics, but also the medical community. Like, how do we actually unfold these in a appropriate fashion? You know, like, just as you were saying with Wellbutrin or Celexa or benzodiazepines, like these numb us, right? It's like, are you feeling anything? Like, let's get rid of it. And you can see it in the definitions of our categories of our medications, anti-anxiety, antidepressants, antipsychotics. If you're feeling anything, let's like make it neutral and then go back to this like machine that we're in and keep, you know, chugging along this capitalistic machine, as opposed to, and so these are suppressive therapies as opposed to like psychedelics, which I think of as evocative therapies. They bring stuff to the surface. So you're going to start feeling, you're going to start seeing. And it's a completely different paradigm in terms of how we're even approaching mental health care. And there's only a small percentage, I think, of even the psychedelic therapists that really would get this conversation that we're talking about, let alone mainstream psychiatry and Western medicine. It's just a completely different way of looking at it.
Yeah, did you know now that they have a ketamine nasal spray?
No.
Did you hear about this? No. So I guess
who made that? That's crazy.
A pharmaceutical company. I forget who it was.
Yeah, it's Janssen, which is like it's owned by Johnson & Johnson.
So essentially what they did is like you can't have one. Like you can't, like, they don't prescribe it and you go get it at CVS. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but doctor's offices, psychiatry offices, if you go in and you're having like a huge episode of PTSD or anxiety or depression, they essentially will administer you a couple of sniffs off of a ketamine inhaler.
Yeah, so this is a whole area of controversy in and of itself. So ketamine has been used almost for two decades in the mental health system by psychotherapists and psychiatrists to do psychotherapy with it, essentially. So it's like the only legal form, and it's the longest legal, you know, psychedelic-assisted therapy that we've had. What Johnson & Johnson did saw that there was a lot of data with generic ketamine, and that's available very cheaply. Like, I've been able to prescribe, and I've prescribed people these nasal sprays of ketamine. It has like 1.5 grams in it, which is a lot of ketamine, for $58 delivered to your door here in New York City. This new bottle of it's called S-ketamine, where they basically take the mirror image. So most molecules that you make in a laboratory have a mirror image, like a right and left hand glove. They like look the same, but really they're not identical. But the way companies get around patents is that they can split them and then say, oh, look, new molecule, new patent, and then like continue it on. So what they did is they looked, and you know, it's already generic in this country. So that same bottle of 1.5 grams of ketamine will cost you about, of S-ketamine now, is about $15,000 compared to $58.
Oh my
but
God.
They got like FDA approval.
And then they outlaw the regular ketamine.
They didn't outlaw it, but it's really marketing is what's happening now.
Right.
Like, right, you haven't heard of this other version that's been around for 20 years because no one's standing to profit off of this because this is made for pennies somewhere. You know, so
yeah, when stuff is too cheap, this yeah. capitalist society is yeah. like the only values money is yeah. like, what can we do with it? It's worthless.
Yeah, and it's a nasal spray version, right? And that's not what people are actually using for therapy or have been using it. Usually people either inject it in the arm or in the vein or use an oral,
oh, really? For
oral for ketamine. Yeah. So
how do you normally take ketamine? I've done it a couple times. It was
people snort it.
Snort lines of it.
Okay.
Yeah. yeah. And yeah. then you fall on the ground and foam all over your dorm room.
It is
yeah,
fun. We watched Bob Ross for like 2 hours. just painting. Just like
why ketamine? Nasally yeah. and other stuff, you know, you eat or, you know,
stick up your butt.
Is ketamine? Does it just
are you talking about specifically why they developed this, or
is it
different?
Well, because like you don't snort mushrooms, right? You eat them. So yeah. is it just the way that it's broken down in your body? Is that just the different?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's part of it. But also, like MDMA, you can snort in theory. Right? Most people just take it orally. So you're like, shaking your head. Yeah.
So, I snorted some Molly like a year ago, and I just thought it was cocaine. Everybody kept handing it to me. I just kept going to the bathroom and snorting it, and my nose was so fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, why would you sniff that? I'm like, I thought it was coke. I thought it was wonderful, wonderful cocaine.
It's better than accidentally eating cocaine, though, because that'll make your whole face completely, completely numb. When did you start to? Was this something that you were always interested in? Like, as a youngster, like, were you into psychedelics, or was it something?
Not at all. I'm 39 right now, and
me too. You look way fucking younger.
What's the difference between you two that would make him look younger than you, Panoia?
I'm not sure.
Is it the luscious hair?
Perhaps. And that I've been eating meatball sandwiches and you've been eating ketamine.
Oh, man. So, yeah, I will keep myself out of trouble and not talk.
No. It's cool.
Personal, yeah.
You're among friends.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, so 5 years ago, I did not have long hair, no piercings, no jewelry. I was actually raised Jehovah's Witness, or actually initially Seventh Day Adventist, converted to being Jehovah's Witness when I was 7, and then in my teens left the church. So up until 5 years ago or so, I'd smoked pot like 5 times in my life,
no
and not
kidding.
Tried anything
up until
else.
How long ago?
Like 5 years ago.
Wow,
that's nuts.
So I was very much like a traditional Western doctor, and until the system failed me. Like, I got in and realized I jumped through all those hoops going to all those universities, and I was just like, I'm fucking miserable. Like what did I? What's that?
Why?
Because I wasn't happy with my life, right? I was telling myself that getting this degree or getting this position, getting this title, getting tenure, doing like, and I finally realized there's no more hoops to jump through.
Yeah, you're just chasing
I kept saying that, you know, once I get there, I'll be happy. And I realized that wasn't going to be the case. And so then I tried traditional antidepressants. They not only didn't help, they made me feel worse. But I did go into psychotherapy, which was very helpful. And so for me, but it was very slow. And that was kind of, it was just serendipitous. I started doing dream analysis within a few months. And then a childhood best friend of mine got introduced to DMT. And this is back in California. And as you guys probably know, DMT is what people think of as, you know, being secreted when we dream and when we when we have near-death experiences and stuff. And so it just happened to correlate that when I was doing dream analysis, my friend was smoking DMT. And then it ended up being like, you know, he told me, he's like, hey, this is, you know, something interesting for months and months. And I was just like, no, these are addictive. They're dangerous. And then finally, he's like, no, they used to do research on this in the 50s and 60s. And I was living at Boston in my psychiatry training at Harvard at the time. And I'm just like, so I finally like went to our search engine and looked, and I'm like, oh shit, like he's right. Like these papers were published. And then, you know, a few months later, I just got interested, was emailing people, and then met. So Rick Doblin, who started MAPS,
yeah,
lives two blocks away from the hospital.
So
that
we, talked to
that
we talked to him before. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he just, yeah, he lived a couple blocks away. We became friends and just got involved in all this stuff. And
isn't that weird?
How grew out my hair and had to use conditioner and all the rest.
He's like, hey, man, okay, I'd like to tell you about this, but your hookah collection has got to go up.
Totally. He gave you a starter pack. Yeah. He's like, come back in 10 days.
I need a conch shell necklace.
You come back floating on a cloud. Yeah. Well, it's funny, that whole like chasing and never having it. Like, we're both comics, and like it's kind of like this thing of he's way more you know, boring and not as funny as I am. But he's been doing
like
it way
comics,
longer.
I never would have guessed.
He's been doing it way longer than I have. But you kind of have this thing where it's like, you know, you get this and it's like, yeah, it's not enough. Like the calendar's not full. This is not, I don't have enough spots. But and you kind of have that like continuous chasing something that, and then you realize you're just chasing.
I've seen the same thing with in a lot of whatever mediums or whatever, where you like you get to where you're supposed to get, you're always chasing, you get to where you're supposed to get. And I've seen Chappelle and even like Carrot Top and people like that, Dane Cook, where you get to where you're playing stadiums where you can't go any bigger, and then it's like, oh fuck,
what's next, the moon,
anything.
Like
and then those guys always end up working out and like working on their bodies.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's very true. Yeah, you need
to get stronger and like, I don't know, let me try to live longer, I guess.
It's like we're all looking in that mirror and seeing like a fat kid.
But it's interesting. It's that thing that we started with. It's like it does so nothing external. That seems to be like the rule of what we're doing. And I was just, again, talking to my buddy about this out at Tompkins Square Park about that seems to be it, right? We're talking about once we think like we should do something, we should be somewhere and not just be present, is we cause ourselves this suffering. And the interesting thing is the more one explores this, is that this seems to link to like Buddhism and Hinduism. Like I was not into researching or learning anything about those religions, but they're all kind of saying the same thing. It's like we're just here to be present and, just look. You know?
Did leaving
that was so hard, the present stuff, I guess Buddhism, where it's just like sit there and like, that's a bird, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
That's an ant, whatever. Just I'm here.
Yep.
So hard.
I know, it really is. And that's something that I think I'm like, you know, we all search for something. When you have those moments, and Ari, I want to ask you this, when you have those moments and it's like I'm in a moment right now where, you know, like you were saying at a concert, like go to a festival, eat acid or mushrooms, and like every note lasts a million, fucking, it's just amazing. When you're in that and you're like, I'm experiencing this, coming back down to normal everyday life sometimes is like frustrating because it's like, I want to feel the way I felt.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean by that?
I just went to the Glastonbury Festival and I gave most of my group mushrooms for the first time. Eight people, I guess. Mm. A couple people have done it before. This one dude, Angus, took to it. And the next day, he's like, can we do those again? And I'm like, oh, it's probably not going to work. You probably have to eat double to get it. And
yeah.
He's like, oh, whatever. And he just, for four straight days, just eating mushrooms for 4 days. And at the end, turned his phone back on. The text came in from his work. And he just looked at his phone. And he was like, you know what? Fuck this. And he just threw his fucking iPhone as far as he could. Like, he wanted to stay there.
And now a month later, he's like at the Verizon store, like, I need a new phone. You know, because it's just impossible. But I guess it's that kind of subtle balance of trying to figure out how to like maintain a level of like, okay, well, I know I can just kind of enjoy this moment and quiet the, you know, stress and anxiety, the past and the future, and just be here in that moment. And is that what the goal of what you're offering to your clients, basically, in a nutshell, is kind of to...
In a nutshell, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is, like, you know, I think about the unfolding of psychedelics, right? And whether, you know, right now it's being medicalized, right? It's being said that you're supposed to get a prescription, you've got to go see someone who's trained, which I'm not necessarily against, right? But I do think there's an accessibility issue because there's not many therapists. This is going to be very expensive. It's just not available right now. But also, like, we need to make it acceptable and palatable to Western culture, right? We're a country that's been in a culture that's been extremely traumatized and very conservative. And so this,
What's
that?
It's Elizabethan almost.
Yeah. And so because some people are like, oh no, let's just like legalize and recreationalize and decriminalize it. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, like that. Like, look what happened last time we had this. It was scary to the country and we actually, you know, slowed this stuff down. And I relate to it because I was raised Jehovah's Witness. So I came to this very cautious. So I think we have to like kind of make it palatable for society as a whole, so that it kind of unfolds in a way with integrity. So, you know, and I say that to, you know, so when I first start working with someone, it's not necessarily that they're spiritual. You know, they may just want to, most people after reading Michael Pollan's book, just want to feel less anxious and less depressed.
Yeah.
And, you know, and to me, that's, you know, I think of it as like healing the traumas of this lifetime, like from birth to now. And, you know, if you're just wanting to do that, but you're Christian or you don't believe in God, you know, and you go to ayahuasca in Peru in the jungle, and then you start seeing past ancestors or, you know, connecting to past lives and seeing all these like crazy images. And again, all you want to do is feel better. That can be not only not helpful, it can be traumatic.
Right.
So, you know, there's certain medicines, like I would say MDMA is number one, where it stays on the plane of this reality. You don't really get into having strong visuals, et cetera. So
it's more emotional.
Just based on, again, on this consensus reality. And so that's where I think, you know, your average person, if they haven't had a lot of experience, you know, you try to start with something like MDMA or low doses of ketamine that also don't get too out there. But what naturally seems to happen is that as more people heal their anxiety and depression and feel more present, they get much more curious about the meaning of life and spirituality and what happens, you know, after we die and how do you want to live your life. And then naturally people seem to be then using psychedelics, not just for, again, healing, but for spirituality and enlightenment.
Sure.
And then they'll go out and explore that.
And I'm sure a lot of people that go in Christian or, you know, I subscribe to this particular religion probably end up leaving a lot more empathetic and compassionate and open to the fact that, like, you know, I'm not right, everyone else is wrong.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a little like more you're entitled to your opinion. Yeah.
Exactly, like you're a little more open, and
or the other way around though, because I actually fought a lot with my mom and was very anti-religion for a long part of my life after I went to college, because I was like, oh, I'm atheist, agnostic, all this is bullshit. It caused me so much pain. It actually gave me more healing between me and my mom and religion, because I think if you look at the fundamentals of almost all religions, they're saying something beautiful about love and connection. It's just exactly
but right.
It's
just the brand.
Yeah, you get into like, you really believe God had a son, and like that's almost beyond the point.
Yeah,
the point is, what did he say?
Yeah,
you know? We were talking about that the other day. That I think like my religion is just like I don't know. Like I think that's what my belief is, that I don't think I have the right to tell anyone that they're right or wrong.
Yeah.
Because we're nothing.
Yeah.
We don't matter.
Yeah. I was Orthodox Jewish, which is similar, just religious, like
heavy,
you know, cult, like a community. And everyone who left Orthodox Judaism, I'm sure that too, whatever Metzger was, I think he might have been Jehovah too. It's like, fuck you to the people that you're leaving for a while. Like, you're wrong. Yeah. And then after a while, it's like, hey, fine, do whatever you want. It's fine.
Yeah.
But that's that anger early on.
Yeah, my dad kind of like came into religion one just all of a sudden, like it was alcohol and then it was Catholicism, and it was very heavy, and it was very like, you know, you're going to be an altar boy, we're going to do this, we're going to church every week, and I hated it because it just felt like anything else. Like if I was forced to play hockey or whatever, then it's like I'm going to hate hockey. Just stop forcing me to. But when it's religion and it's like the music you're listening to has backwards messages and it makes you scared. Did you feel guilt like leaving the church and leaving your fam like that?
Oh,
like,
God. Yeah. And I think even now, I mean, I think the lessons of all the, you know, the traumatic messages are still in my body, you know? And so that's one thing I also think about in terms of psychedelic healing, like Western medicine and Western psychology has all been in the mind. And a lot of the healing, especially the deeper stuff, I think is about healing the body, you know, and connecting us and realizing that we're, you know, mind, body and spirit kind of beings and not just the mind.
Yeah. I got two questions for you. When you said earlier, like, the last time we tried to legalize it, it went bad. What are you talking about?
Meaning like just in the 60s when it was all like, you know, everyone used everything. And then you've got guys like Leary, and I have a mentor that's amazing. He's like, you know, he's a historian. He's like, we can't judge anyone as being good or bad until at least a few hundred years after they're dead. You know, we say, was he net good or net bad? I don't know. But he was at least reckless and irresponsible is when I think of Timothy Leary. To just be like, everyone should take this, like take down the government. Like, again, it was just too much for people, and it was scary, and it didn't respect like these shadow parts of ourselves that we explore individually in therapy, but also as a culture, we're exploring our shadows. And so, you know, we built up Christianity for a reason. And so do we want to take it down as a whole? Yeah, I don't think anyone's truly happy deep down inside, but it's like it's set there for a reason because we're terrified of something within ourselves.
I got to know Ken Kesey very well before he passed away. And I was just out in Oregon chatting with his friend about how he volunteered for research at Stanford University. It turned out it was run by the CIA, and they were using psychedelics as a way of like
controlling,
like truth serum type stuff. And he took it and he held it together enough to get out on the streets and be like, you know, I'm okay, I don't need to be like institutionalized. And then he got a job at the hospital, and in found the keys to a room, and in that room there was a bottle of 500 hits of Hoffman's like pure LSD.
Really?
And he opened the door, took it, locked it back up, and then left. And then he started throwing these parties called the acid tests, where he would spike a thing of Kool-Aid and everybody would pay a dollar to drink it.
Oh, no,
they knew. Okay. And then the Grateful Dead would be the house band, and it was this
damn
incredible. And that was Tom Wolfe wrote the electric Kool-Aid acid test. And, yeah, it was wild. And he ended up kind of turning he was like the West Coast Leary. And it was more for like the having a moment, moving consciousness ahead a step, and everyone was accepted and loved. And it was really wild to be able to chat with him. And I talked to him way too young. I was like 20. Yeah. I had no idea what I was talking about. But now at 40, I'm kind of like, damn, I wish he died. I wish I could have had a chance to chat with him. But you're right, though. There's those folks that, you know, at that point, that because of those experiments, that's when they decided, now this should be illegal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And Rick Doblin always says medicalization leads to legalization. You know, if we look at the way marijuana's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's just doing it respectfully, I think, palatably for culture. And that might end up being faster than we think. I mean, look at Denver and Oakland. I mean, they've already decriminalized mushrooms, and then Oakland plant medicines. That's a pretty big deal.
I remember when Denver decriminalized marijuana, it was the first one. Just said, in this city, do whatever you
want. I was living out there when that happened.
You can't just do that. Yeah. It's like, we did. Cops here aren't going to bother you.
Yep.
And then the state followed within like 10 years, I guess. But what's the microdosing ketamine? What are the effects it's having on people? And like, what are you hoping to get with that?
What do you mean by microdosing ketamine?
Is that what you're prescribing people? So
in my clinic, I use oral ketamine during psychotherapy sessions, or sometimes injectable in the arm. So I mean low dose ketamine, meaning it's like not at an anesthetic level or completely dissociative level. It's more like a trance state. So
it just helps.
It's just a lower
Like a buzz.
It's interesting because some people come in, a lot of people who have never tried a psychedelic but are looking for legal psychedelic therapy, so they'll try ketamine for the first time with me. And people are pretty scared because they hear all these stories about ketamine and all this stuff about psychedelics. But I actually tell people, you know, using a low dose oral ketamine is much less jarring than the first time any of us like got really drunk. I mean, we got used to it now, and we'll go out to bars and it's a normal thing. But that was really fucking weird the first time
lose
our mind doing that.
So
I think it's more like a gentle trance or like a daydream kind of a thing.
Then what do you do while they're on it?
So normally I'll have music on and they'll have an eye mask. And so either they're listening to it through headphones or just ambient. The sessions are usually like 90 minutes to 2 hours. These are patients that I've seen already, so I have a rapport with them. And, you know, within 10 or 15 minutes, we'll set an intention, we'll light a candle and say, you know, what is it that you want to work on? They'll take the ketamine. They have to hold the oral one under their tongue for 10 minutes. It absorbs. Usually they'll start feeling something by the time that 10 minutes ends. And then, yeah, usually within another 15, 20 minutes, they're in a state where they want to lay down. They're like in a trance state. And I just kind of really support them. If they say anything, I write it down, if there's any specific movements, but kind of just go with it. But most of the time they're like in their own process. And then kind of at, you know, the last 25, 30 minutes, they start coming to a little bit more, and I'll kind of just, you know, be there for them, make sure that they know they're safe and stuff.
So you're not asking any questions. You're not talking. It's basically, you're just there as like a safety net.
Yeah. During ketamine, which is very different than say an MDMA session. MDMA people tend to be wanting to talk.
Yeah, no shit.
I don't have to tell you guys
just
that.
Take Molly and fucking, you're like planning businesses.
So frustrating.
You're like, let's open a fucking Wawa.
And you realize that you told people, I'm like, oh, goddamn.
It's
like,
the
and
worst.
I did sort of mean that, but like, so I shouldn't have said anything.
It's so bad hanging out at like a Molly party, not on it. Like, I should be charging all of you $100 just to listen to your bullshit right now. I hear you, though. It's right.
So they set an intent. So they're like, I want to work on
guilt.
Okay, is that something?
Well, yeah, trust or you know, more surrender. I kind of leave it general. I don't say, you know, like specifically wanting to, you know, figure out why my girlfriend cheated on me. And
right, it's more of like I gotta clear the attic.
Yeah,
What do I want to get rid of? I want to get rid of anxiety. I want to love myself more.
Yeah,
I want to stuff like that.
Yeah, allow in love, or what's keeping me from love? So keeping it more general, because we also want to like. Again, since these are non-specific amplifiers of the unconscious, we want to honor whatever's coming up is going to come up and not judge it or try to direct it as much as possible.
So just the intention ahead of time is directed a little bit?
That's just to kind of get people in the space and honor that we're about to do something, you know, that I consider sacred. We're opening up the unconscious, something that's difficult, that they put trust in me and all this stuff to just not have it, you know, come in, pop in, take some ketamine and go back to work or something.
And then they use you as a sounding board sometimes?
Or sometimes. You know, I'll tell them really I'm there for whatever they want. If they need to switch the music, I'm kind of feeling out the room energetically to see what's happening. If something gets really intense, I might tone down the music or something. But again, it's very different than an MDMA session, where some people will describe MDMA obviously as a heart opener, right? Where I have a mentor of mine who does ketamine therapy also, and she'll describe it as a mind opener. So it's a much more internalized experience. Right. And I think of it as like developing your own internal therapist for yourself. I see more like significant change for people between sessions with ketamine than without. You know, other most of the other sessions when with normal psychotherapy, it's like the work that's being done in the room, and people really do a lot of good work on their own in between sessions, sure, which has been very, very different.
Well, I think because you're probably shown a light that you didn't know was there before.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And the restructuring is important, though, because I kind of think another way I think of ketamine is like if we have like, I don't know, an image of the mind or the brain and you like scatter it with the ketamine and it opens up and you're kind of like jumbling it a bit and then you're kind of it settles back down in a hopefully in a better place. That's why I think you could have, you know, ketamine can get very dark, too. Like ketamine. You know, there's all these stories from the 60s and 70s, like there was ketamine cults and people being found. There's this one this woman from a famous family that was ended up like being found with her head cut off in like a forest or something, I think. Out.
By the others?
No, that's a K-hole.
People actually don't know. It's an interesting story that went unsolved. But ketamine can get very dark. And so I think of like what's happening in that state where we actually open up the mind and as it's like reconstituting. That's a critical period of, am I going to reconstitute in a better place or am I going to be more confused? And that's where I think doing it in the right set and setting with someone who's trained can be very helpful.
Well, that's what McKenna said, right? About all tripping, all psychedelics,
absolutely.
Is set and setting,
absolutely.
Taking it in the right place. We were talking about laying on the grass in, where was it, Scotland? Where you're just like, fuck it. Now's a great time to eat a whole hit of acid.
It was Glastonbury Music Festival. But it was a giant farm where it's like,
just laying
it's
on the grass.
In.
Like,
it's
this, like this, the setting is perfect.
This, yeah, there's... People can help you like medically around, and you can't wander into the oncoming traffic. There's just no danger.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's literally the most natural. And there's music, and there's friends, and
yeah.
I think for the longest time I did psychedelics with I did it all the wrong way. Mm. I would eat a shitload of acid, and then we would like drink a keg and like just you know stand and laugh, and it was like a party drug. And then like I've done it a couple times on a micro dose and soberly.
Yeah.
And maybe had a beer or two at the end just as like a warm blanket to kind of land a little bit smoother, you know?
Sure.
But I enjoyed that way more.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was fun to laugh with my friends for, you know, a day and a half uncontrollably till my face felt like it was going to break apart. But what am I getting out of it?
Are you separating? So we talked to the guy,
Doblin.
Doblin, yeah.
Guy Doblin.
And he was like, my question was like, what are you doing to like make people think this is as a medical treatment instead of a party drug? So he was like, we never refer to this as Molly.
Yeah.
Because that's a party name. What do you do to like?
Again, so that's part of the intention setting prepping, because a lot of people will email me or message me and be like, oh, I would like to do ketamine. And I'm like, well, it's possible, but really we've got to come in here. We've got to build rapport. So really at least 3 or 4 sessions that we work together. Without ketamine, then we'll schedule a session, and then they've got to commit to 3 or 4 sessions to really follow up on the work, because it's really, you know, there's a lot of most ketamine clinics out there that have been around, say, the last 10 years or so, were started by pain medicine doctors, anesthesiologists, or general care doctors, and not psychiatrists. And so they really, you go in and they're like bright white lights, you know, a nurse in there, they aren't playing music, they're
very
just injecting
sterile.
People with ketamine. And, and it, that can be very helpful. But I think if you are more attentive to the entire process, preparation, and then the integration, you can get even more out of it. So
if you were to walk someone through, let's say somebody couldn't afford to, you know, come in and meet or go through the whole session, and they had, let's say, an ounce of mushrooms or whatever. You know, there's a lot of people that are quote unquote microdosing.
Yeah.
Right. What is an actual, like, you know, you hear a lot of, even Google it, and it's like, what does microdosing mean? Some people do like a day on, 4 days off, you know, once every other day.
Yeah.
Eat a like half a thumbnail or point whatever, and you're trying to reach.
It's kind of unknown.
Is there an actual, like, you know, from your perspective, is there like a proper.
Directions. Yeah, so I think there's actually one of my mentors, he's also a MAPS researcher named Torsten Passy, just published a book on microdosing like in the last month. And that one's a really good one. There's one or two that came before it, but I think this is really the best one that's out there. I'm actually a big proponent, and I think microdosing has a lot of potential because, you know, most people think of it as about a 10% dose of a normal full psychedelic, you know, so like say 10 micrograms of LSD or, you know, 2.5, 0.2 or 0.3 grams of mushrooms as opposed to 2 or 3 grams. What I think is very fascinating about, and there isn't much research on microdosing right now, is that I think of, say, microdosing LSD or psilocybin, that it opens you up enough, kind of like when you're, if you go out socially to a party or on a date or something, you take a little bit of alcohol, where that's actually, it can ease you, it can calm you, and you can be more yourself. Versus, but if you take, the problem with alcohol is that it's also a disinhibitor. So you take too much and you aren't yourself anymore. Right. So the nice thing with microdosing is that it can be that just enough opening, being a little bit more yourself, being a little bit more present, essentially, is what we're talking about. So, so can you be present but not have to be out in a field somewhere or with a therapist in a room, but out here functioning and actually practicing those tools? So the cool thing about it is, like, you know, again, you do a big MDMA session or ayahuasca, etc. You meet Pachamama and you connect to source and everything is one. And then you go back to hang out with your family the next weekend and you're being assholes to each other. And that's where, again, the work is, how do I respond differently to my sister or my brother, you know, than we have the last 10 or 20 years to actually switch things. And so what I think, where microdosing is a very interesting thing, is that we can go to work, and I'm not recommending this obviously for anyone, but you can be out functioning in the world with other people while on this. So you can kind of be pushing your boundaries and you can be testing this a bit more.
You can
more.
Act normal so you're not losing your job.
Yeah. Or maybe better than normal. I mean, this is where, like, you know, a separate use is, you know, for human creativity and
I saw that about a lot
human
of, like,
potential, like Silicon Valley people.
Yeah, that's what I've
this
heard.
This is fascinating.
These are like CEOs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm taking a tiny bit of acid every day.
And you know what they, you know what a lot of them say too, is that it's like there's a lot more teamwork and a lot more support and a lot more, like, empathy and compassion, where it's like the ego is not the most important. It's not the driver.
Yeah.
It's like taking a backseat, where it's like, Ari, I'm really proud of, like, what you did today in that meeting, and it was amazing, and I'm motivated because, and it's like,
great
you,
job, Tony. Yeah. Like, all right, Tony feels good now.
And it is like, you put a little piece of acid on each other's tongue. Like, yeah.
No, but that's where I see, like, you know, the future of, I mean, if you see how people have, like, now, I mean, I didn't even know about all these designer marijuana products. I went to, like, this meeting last week about, you know, that was kind of combining some psychedelic and marijuana stuff. I didn't know there's all these, like, little products that creams and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that's, like, and then, you know, I saw a company that's, I think, thinking of making packets of, like, a coffee with microdoses of psilocybin now in Colorado in Denver or Oakland, because it's like, if you, you know, dose this every 4 days, I think there is a lot of potential. I also think there's a potential of assholes becoming more assholes in a way. Like, just, like, if you just focus on being a better capitalist, like, you could probably actually do that too, and come up with this really great idea.
You're right.
And so,
it's kind of like mutations from, like, X-Men kind of stuff. Like, if you're bad, it makes you like a villain.
Yeah.
Well, you can also, from like a grifter's standpoint, you can make any type of, like, now you go to, like, any bodega in the city and they have, like, CBD chocolates.
It's crazy.
CBD anything. And it's like, how much of this shit is actually real?
Yeah.
It's like, you know?
Yeah.
You remember with, like, synthetic pot before it was like this awful, like, dangerous K2 shit? You could go to, like, a head shop and get, like, you know, a Playboy, a bong, and, like, some weird thing of, like, you know, devil grass or whatever the fuck they called it, you know, and it's like spice. Yeah. So it's like every 4 days is essentially.
Yes, I was
like
about
the,
to say that. Yeah. You know, so people think about every 4 days. Because
for everything, okay.
I would say it's a little different, but for mushrooms and acid, it's about every 4 days, because you're basically like you build up some tolerance to it. So it's literally just like giving your
I've shown him what time it was.
OK. Just in terms of what the tolerance of the brain. So, you could take it in theory every day. You just wouldn't feel it.
I always heard it tell me, I mean, please correct me, that it was below the ethical amount. So, like.
Below the what?
Efficable.
Like you're not supposed to. If you're feeling it, you took too much.
Right. You'll
exactly.
never feel.
So that's what the actual hard definition of a microdose is, but that's not really what people are mostly doing. I mean, is there maybe science to that we'll see that a subperceptible amount is healing if you do it every 4 days? Maybe. But, you know, I like to think about it just the way I explained it to you. Like, what's my actual experience of what's happening out there?
Yeah. And I think it's the other stuff that you're doing along with it. It's like if you just take, you know, you're taking mushrooms just to take mushrooms, and then it's like you're not doing any of the other work.
It's my alarm. Yeah.
Like a lot of stuff that you were talking about, like, which I'm very interested to ask you about, is like the pre and the post stuff. But, you know, some people can't afford that, and maybe they have access to, you know, 1/2 ounce of mushrooms, and they're like, how do I make this?
Yeah, so honestly, like,
me?
One thing that I've thought of. I mean, because the thing is, I, even being a doctor, et cetera, and being in a position where I'm like, oh, I'm going to be able to open clinics and make a shit ton of money off of this one day, I do not think that this should remain in the hands of just the medical community, because this is our consciousness that we're talking about.
Right.
And again, it's going to be years until this is financially accessible and we have enough people trained. So, I mean, something I think that might be interesting, say if a group of men or you got together with your close friends and said, hey, every Sunday night, you know, on the first Sunday of every month, we're going to get together, you know, or say that you get
book
together
club.
Every Sunday. What's that?
Like a book club.
Yeah, no, really. And or you get together every Sunday, and then one of those Sundays a month, you know, you agree not to drink, or you're not going to be on your phone, and you're just going to like sit around as friends and, you know, once a month take a microdose of mushrooms or half a dose of mushrooms, and then just be together and just do that, you know. It's like 3 hours a week, but how could that shift people if you were actually made a commitment to do something like that?
And like you said, a lot of it is sober available.
Yeah.
Sometimes maybe just spending a Sunday with friends, even without mushrooms, is probably pretty therapeutic.
Yeah.
We're all living in silos right now.
Yeah.
So it's even like, you know, just to be able to spend some time with people.
Everybody needs a Shabbos.
Way to bring it back to religion, yeah. Art. So when you, I don't know if you have to, I don't want to.
I got to take
you
off.
Ari's got to bounce.
If, right. if this ends fast, I'll come back in. But yeah, it's really nice.
Come hang, dude, okay. if you could. I think that for me, guilt and anxiety are two things that I've definitely dealt with quite a bit. Mm. And it's like I'm very hard on myself, and I don't allow myself to just enjoy that moment. You know? And you go talk to a therapist or even like someone who prescribes medication.
Yeah.
Literally, I've had doctors where it's like, call every 3 months, and it's all it is just to go, how you doing? Okay. Well, here, I'll send in your refills.
Yeah.
And that's it. And it's like you're not doing any of the actual work. And it gets very expensive if you're someone without insurance where you've got, you know, you have to pay to go talk to a psychiatrist, but you also have to pay to deal with a, you know, someone who talk therapy.
Yeah.
It's a lot. So if we have these, you know, mushrooms, LSD, MDMA, that you can like self kind of go on your own journey.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I think of, you know, really what causes our suffering. Like I tell people, I see average Joe in my clinic. I have celebrity patients. I have, you know, wealthy non-celebrity patients. I see everyone, and no one for more than like the first 5 minutes of the first session is talking to me about needing to make more money, their job, etc. Everyone's talking about lack of connection. They're talking about relationships, you know, the desire for relationships, or how painful their current relationship is, or cycles of patterns of being disconnected, usually to loved ones or lovers. And that's everyone. And so I think the more disconnected we're becoming as a culture and society, that's causing most of what we're calling mental illness, and a lot of our physical illness. So really, we're just talking about reconnecting in a genuine fashion. And so that's why I think a lot of people can do this on their own, and just building more community and having, you know, doing this with friends in a consistent manner where you start trusting each other. You know, 1 week someone freaks out or two people freak out, and then you get back together, and then you hold space for the rest of your friends on the other weeks. I think there's tremendous potential for this.
Let's say you're someone who doesn't necessarily have a group of friends that wants to embark on that. Is there, you know, I know MAPS has, you know, it's an outlet to meet other people. Mm-hmm. And are there communities that are out there where you can find like, oh, well, I live in Brooklyn, so is there a Brooklyn chapter? Is there a group that would maybe get together and hang?
This is interesting. I mean, if you even go on Facebook, like the first time I ever like went to a music festival, again, it was like early 30s, I got interested in DMT. And so I went on this forum called DMT Saved My Life, which actually still exists. It's like hilarious. I was telling my best friend about this. But I mean, now there's stuff like the Brooklyn Psychedelic Society. There's now like a Manhattan, New York Psychedelic Society. I know these are popping up all over the country. And there's also conferences all the time now. I mean, the Breaking Convention in the UK is, I think, in a week or two, which is the biggest one in Europe. And so if you just start going to more events in the cities around you, I mean, that's granted, we live in a big city, so we're really grateful to have access here. But really, it's just, I think, trying to connect to people everyone seems to be curious about this.
Yeah, really. It's like, getting to a point where, I mean, experience at a young age, and then you kind of get wrapped up in life.
Yeah.
Chasing the dollar and all that shit. And then it's like, yeah, man. Like, I remember there being a time when I felt like a child as an adult. And it's like, I think we want to get back to that pure moment and not like think so much. Do you try to get out of the city as often as possible and just like enjoy nature?
I do. Yeah, it's been hard. So I've only been living here in New York City 2 years, and it's become a bit intense. The summer has been kind of a lot of it feels like for everyone, kind of a very intense summer of feeling a lot of like energy and shifting in our lives. And so I've gotten up to Vermont. I have some mentors up there. But yeah, I mean, there's a beauty to being in the city and all the energy around it too. But yeah, I definitely take a lot of breaks and head up to Vermont quite a bit.
Well, it's a pretty heavy job that you've taken on, like being someone's sounding board. I always think about that sometimes where it's like, I'll leave a therapy session and be like, I hope my therapist has a therapist that they can, like, go chat with.
Yeah, yeah, well, I definitely have a therapist and I'm open about that with my patients. I've somewhat of a public persona now with Instagram and stuff, which I know everything I'm putting out there right now. But I've actually found in a lot of therapists, like when you train, especially in a Freudian background. So I have like half my training has been in Freudian analysis and half in Jungian analysis. And so they say like, oh, it's always good to keep complete, from the psychoanalytic perspective, like you're on the couch and the therapist is behind you, so you're not even seeing the facial reactions of your therapist. So in the beginning, when I started practicing, I was very non-disclosing of anything about myself. But I've actually found just being a more real human being in the room has been more helpful for people. And so, I talk about, my personal experiences with psychedelics with the patient patients where it makes sense. I've had legal experiences, luckily. Through the MAPS program for training, I got to take MDMA legally. I've had two legal ketamine experiences myself. I've been to Peru and Costa Rica, and I've done plant medicines that are legal. And so I'm very open with people about just my own experience in terms of my struggles with mental health and how I've found help.
What were those the ayahuasca experiences like for you? That's something I'm so nervous about. I want to do it so bad, but then I'm like, I'm in the jungle with snakes and you throw up and you shit. I mean, it's a pretty heavy thing to take on.
Yeah. So to me, ayahuasca, I think of them as in terms of ability, so when I think of something like MDMA, again, how it stays on the plane of of this reality, I think of you can do 5 or 10 years of work with MDMA, in 2 or 3 months, and you get the benefit from that with the challenges of what that would take also. When I think of ayahuasca, I think more on the scale of you can get the lessons of not just 10, 20, 30 years, but 50, 100, 500, a millennia, depending, how deep you go and in your spiritual beliefs and all that stuff. And it can come with the benefits of that. But also, you got to be careful with it, because getting all of that download without having the right support when you get back, could look like a manic episode with bipolar, or it could be psychosis. And so one just has to be incredibly careful. So, I mean, the lessons I think that can be gained from ayahuasca experiences are incredibly powerful. I don't think the others really compare. But in ayahuasca, as you were saying, has a purging aspect. So I'm really big right now on the mind body, not just healing the mind, but the body also. And so ayahuasca has this natural aspect of it where there's physical purging and not just vomiting. I think vomiting is one form of purging, but people sweat, people scream, people move, people shake. And, and a colleague of mine, Joe Tafur, who's a physician in the Southwest, he wrote a book recently. The title of it is escaping me right now, but A Fellowship of the River, where he's a physician, again, licensed in the U.S., and he spent about 7 years on and off in Peru, and he talks about all the physical healing that he's seen people go through, and it's not just him, but you see people who have supposedly incurable autoimmune diseases or cancers or chronic pain that get a whole lot better almost immediately sometimes after these experiences. So it's much, much bigger than just, again, feeling better, less anxious, less depressed. I think psychedelics have a huge potential in terms of our general physical and mental health.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like there's some, you hear about people that have had like allergies their whole life to a certain, whatever it may be. And then after one like LSD trip, it's changed.
Yeah. Yeah. And these are stories that I think, a year or two ago, especially before pollen, these were rare, but people, like, I meet people almost every week and know some of them personally where they have had massive, again, what Western medicine has said is incurable illness that's getting a whole lot better very quickly.
So. Do you have any fear at all about, we talk about Western medicine and, like the pharmaceutical world is a fucked up business where it's just keep people on stuff.
Yeah.
Keep people thinking that they need it. And a lot of these even, it's just imaginary.
Yeah.
I've had doctors that are like, you do comedy, huh? Do you get stage fright? And I'm like, no. And they're like, well, here's propanolol in case you do.
Yeah.
And then I do research and I'm like, this thing's a beta blocker. Like, what? I don't need it.
Yeah.
Why do I, like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, why are you just giving me?
Yeah.
So I kind of swore off anything. I have Xanax in case, like, if I'm on a flight and I'm getting real.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't take anything anymore because I'm very interested in kind of like feeling what I'm feeling.
Yeah.
And taking it and being able to kind of like, just put that in a segment of my life and be like, why am I feeling like this?
Yeah.
How can I like acknowledge it?
Yeah.
Not ignore it. And I know that psychedelics are a thing that can like help me just kind of slow everything down
mm-hmm.
and get back to the, that root
yeah.
cause.
Yeah.
You know,
and that reminds me of a quote again of Stan Grof that says, "The full experience of a negative emotion is the funeral pyre to that emotion." So it's again just honoring, like, let yourself feel. If your body is doing something or it's trying to tell you something, you know, it's some lesson that you haven't learned and you've got to go through, and it can be terrifying because we're not used to just letting ourselves feel. And when you can do that, and the big example is ayahuasca, people have, will, you know, again, describe these intense experiences and the healing that comes along with it. And we're essentially talking about experiencing intense emotion. And
yeah.
so it's like, when we think about it, well, why is that so awful? Like you're going to go through it. You're going to be fine. Rarely, if ever, do people die from this stuff.
Yeah.
So it's just, yeah, just diving into it.
Now, I noticed on your site that you do what's called house calls.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that all? What does that mean?
That just means, so I work with some like celebrities and athletes and clients. So some people prefer the privacy of their home. That's really it. So, you know, but, and so I can do legally ketamine, you know, I can travel with it and take it to someone's home, do therapy.
How does that happen?
Sort of,
how do you legally, how are you, because I knew we were talking about like underground, you know, you never know. You hear some of these stories about some like uh-huh. the shaman that are kind of maybe running a dicey operation or whatever, and then to legally be able to, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Like in researching for myself, I was like, holy like that's amazing that there's a legal, you somehow mm-hmm. feel better about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? What's that process like for you? Like to be able to go through like legally?
Yeah. So it was interesting. I mean, that was new to me in the last like year or so, but you know, I kind of just looked up the laws and people have been doing house calls. I mean, doctors have done really house calls was kind of at the foundation of being a physician. And so, I just had to ask someone that had, you know, ordered ketamine and was doing it in their office. And then I was like, okay, well, what do you do? Oh, I go and I enter my name, my address. It was actually pretty interestingly easy. My medical license number. And after not too long, I had, you know, bottles of ketamine that were delivered, and you've got to store them in a safe, and there's certain laws around it. And just, you know, documenting how much I use, who I use it with. And it really was a pretty simple process. It's just interesting because, like, you know, most doctors don't go out and do private practice at all anymore. It's mostly a psychiatric thing, but even the psychiatrists really, you know, you really operate within bounds of a certain, you know, set of standards, and you know, you're not breaking any standards by doing this kind of work. I just think of it as a little bit, you know, thinking outside of the box and just like, oh, like, you know, this might be fun and it will be helpful to people because, you know, set and setting for some people being in their home is really, you know, what they need.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I learn a lot about someone by going into their home also, right? Because there's one thing that they walk in my door and then you kind of prepare and present yourself versus walking in energetically and just seeing what people's space is like and all that stuff. So it just adds another interesting dimension to all this.
Yeah. And you probably have an inherent ability to like adapt and react to whatever setting it is. So you're like, okay, this person's got very vibrant colors. They're very, you know, like, and then you could kind of, you know, adapt to it
yeah.
and help them, you know, get to where they need to be.
Yeah. And the nice thing with ketamine is that, you know, ketamine, generally most people are doing sessions 90 minutes to 2 hours. But you're still pretty rocked after taking a high dose of IV ketamine. Now we're talking like IV or intramuscular dosing. Those can be, up there with what people describe of a DMT experience. Like it's a profound, profound experience. There's a physician named Gabor Mate who writes a lot about kind of, the society and causing our suffering. But he's also kind of in the psychedelic, he's like one of the psychedelic grandfathers also. Sorry, I was just talking about, I was talking to him a couple months ago, and he's done, you know, a lot of psychedelics. He's had experiences with ayahuasca, and he had just done ketamine. And he's like, hey, Will, he's like, what do you think about, I told him that I have a ketamine practice. He's like, what do you think about it? And I was like, huh. I was like, what do you think? He's like, no, I want to hear from you first. And I was like, you know, my ketamine experiences, again, it was up there, top three most profound experiences I've ever had in my entire life, you know, and this is something that's completely medically and legally available right now.
Yeah.
And he's like, I agree with you 100%. And this is a guy who's done, again, a lot of ayahuasca and other spiritual experiences. And so, yeah, I think it's one of the psychedelics that's getting less attention right now. It's definitely in the news, but again, as people are like, oh my God, like what about the psilocybin? What about MDMA? When are we going to get it? I'm like, this powerful thing, ketamine is available.
It's here
right
now. Yeah. 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 And I think it's one of those things as always, you know, it gets a negative stigma because of college dorm K-holes and, you know, oh, it's cat tranquilizer and all that. You hear this, you know, you're going to have a flashback. You're going to turn into a bottle of orange juice if you take too much acid and that whole, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But no one ever talks about what happens if you take, you know, too much Lexapro or too much Ritalin or whatever. I mean, it's just, it's sad that I get a little bit nervous when you see the big pharma, the eyeball, all of a sudden is looking at your medicine, your spiritual medicine, and they're like, oh, well, we can make a ton of money off of MDMA or psilocybin. And then it's like, fuck, this is going to turn into a real shitty situation fast.
It's interesting to see. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of money definitely pouring into the psilocybin space now with ketamine. I don't know. I go back and forth of how worried I am. The reality is that I think this is just, I mean, this is consciousness and society unfolding. I think, you know, but to me, that was tempered by Oakland and by Denver decriminalizing. To me, I don't know. I just see this as all as unfolding. I'm trying to just do my best and act with as much integrity as this whole
totally,
thing unfolds.
Totally.
Like, it's not for me to try to figure out all the solutions.
No, of course not. You know, and a lot of folks, like, I've personally taken a look at websites to try to see, like, where do you volunteer to be a subject in, you know, some assisted therapies and things like that. Do you recommend that anybody goes anywhere to take a look?
Yeah, I mean, so MAPS has on their website all the active sites for MDMA, but they're pretty much, I mean, I think MAPS for the entire phase three trials is going to see like 200 or 300 people across the country. The wait list's already in the thousands.
Yeah.
So it really just depends. There's a psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression. That's going to be starting at multiple sites across the country very soon. So that's something that people could potentially jump in on. USONA is the major funder for that work, and also Compass Pathways. They're like the big pharma company that's come into the psilocybin space, but they're both going to be doing clinical trials soon. I know Columbia, the Washington Heights campus here in Manhattan, is actively recruiting for ketamine for cocaine addiction and heroin addiction right now. So they've got spots right now.
It's really wild. I remember going to St. Kitts in the West Indies when I was about 23 or 24. And there was a guy that was just walking around the beach, and he was like, I've got mushrooms, I've got Ibogaine, I've got this. And he was like selling Ibogaine as like a party drug. And I'm like, I never heard of it. And this was like, I had to wait till I got home to like look it up and research it. It was 2 weeks in the West Indies, no internet, no phones or whatever. And I looked it up and I'm like, what the fuck is this guy selling this for to people?
Yeah. Wow.
That's a drug that like I've watched research on, and it's like, the heroin addicts saying that they felt brushes inside of their body cleaning all of the toxic impurities and coming out and being clean. And that's a heavy, heavy substance.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, it's the most fascinating one personally. You know, if and when it becomes legal, that's the top of my list of something I want to try. But you see, I mean, the potential for things like heroin, where you think of these people on, you know, I rarely like to say, you know, one person has more trauma than the other, but it is, you know, pretty clear that people that have heavy heroin addictions have had very, very intense lives and a lot of trauma. And so one of the beautiful things is, you know, it's the amount of time that you get to work with Ibogaine. It lasts, I think the entire experience is something like 36 hours, where the peak of it's like 8 or 10 hours, you know. And I've had one person explain to me, and it's been confirmed by someone, a friend of mine who's guided a lot of people through Ibogaine, that they, you know, this one person described it to me as every experience that they've had in their life from birth until that present moment, they re-experienced fully from every person's perspective. And
holy
that,
shit.
Yeah. And so that, and once they explained it that way, it's like, now I can see why that can be so healing. And if you're able to really go through that, and that would be a really wretched, difficult experience, you can come out the other end and not need to be addicted to anything again.
Yeah.
Because I think of addiction as their coping strategies to deal with the world. And you know, and a lot of us will think like we should be grateful. I mean, some of those people wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for heroin, or wouldn't be alive if it were not for their alcoholism, because they couldn't have tolerated the pain of their
reality. That's a great way to look at it. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's we're all kind of looking for a hug, you know?
Yeah.
And I've thought about it a lot, where it's like, we're kind of handed a lens at a certain moment. Maybe something happens in our life, or some elder says something. Mm-hmm. And it like makes you feel guilty, or makes you feel, you know, insecure about something, and you start to see everything through that.
Yeah.
And I kind of think about how to get back to that moment, like put on your scuba gear and kind of dive as deep as possible and unkink that wire.
Yeah.
And then maybe be able to go through. I kind of felt like, personally, I've kind of felt this like weird disconnection with everything. I feel like I've got friends, I've got family, I've got loved ones, whatever, but I'm always alone.
Yeah.
And I kind of always have to be. I always have one foot out the door because I'm scared to completely commit to anything. What the fuck makes me think like that? You know what I mean? So I kind of am interested to really kind of put the, you know, put the, you know, headlight on and go mine and find out what the hell's happening.
I mean, have you ever had any intentional psychedelic experiences yourself?
No, I've never. I've given myself a little bit of a, I'm not going to freak out this time. That's been my only intention, but I definitely want to.
Yeah.
And it's something where, I mean, that's pretty much kind of how I found you, was like in researching it, because you type in NYC, like psychedelic, you know, therapeutic. I've done a lot of talk therapy. I've done cognitive behavioral therapy, suggestive hypnotherapy.
Wow.
It works, but it's not, again, this is shit that's already in there.
Yeah.
It's just like kind of clearing your way through that attic and kind of cleaning house.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I mean, and it sounds like, you've been working hard on yourself. And one of the important things is looking at these patterns, and you've kind of hinted at a pattern that you have, because we'll keep ourselves in these cycles kind of mostly unconsciously. I mean, psychology will use terms like, you know, attachment issues or, you know, attachment types and stuff like that, because we'll try to get out of it unconsciously. But, you know, psychedelics can be helpful in that sort of process. It can break us out of those completely. So.
Well, you know, what's funny, too, is like I know that the psychedelic, like I'll go to a concert and I'll take acid to be on acid at a concert, or I'll go to a concert and eat mushrooms and beyond mushrooms at a concert, and that's why I'm doing it, and I'm not looking for anything else but fun.
Yeah,
and that's awesome.
Yeah,
but I know that there is something with a small amount, and just kind of like knowing that it has a property that instead of taking some pharmaceutical bullshit, you know what I mean. So that's something that I'm definitely excited about.
Yeah,
and microdosing is something that, you know, it's there, and you want to make sure you're doing it right. I guess that's the thing.
Yeah.
So,
and that one's a much safer. Yeah, low kind of lower risk.
Yeah. Well, it's cool. You recommended a couple books while we were chatting, so anybody that's interested in it can always go check it out. Unfortunately, Google and YouTube is kind of full of anybody's an expert these days.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of misinformation out there. It's a little scary.
That's the fuck. Sure. That's the scary part, because you really don't know what you're doing.
Yep.
You know? So it's pretty awesome that you do what you do. And thank you so much for coming to chill with us. You know?
Yeah, this has been fun. Thanks
can
for
you,
having
me. Can you tell everybody that's watching and listening like what where they can find all things you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've just got two pieces right now. Just my personal practice website, willsuemd.com. And then I have a social media page where I post more like public things about talks I do or podcasts and that sort of thing. So it's just willsuemd on Instagram. And that's it.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
All right.
Really
great
appreciate
to meet
it. You. All right. And as always, folks, you can head to Amigos Pod on Twitter and Instagram, AmigosPod. Mike Fenoya, at Mike Fenoya on Twitter and Instagram for comedy dates, MikeFenoya.com. And head over to the Facebook discussion group. Thank you so much, and we'll catch you next week. Peace.